Good evening and welcome to this special holiday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for July 4th, 2016. On today's show, we'll hear giant Palouse earthworm science. At a meeting of the Palouse Prairie Foundation, University of Idaho Plant, Soil, and Entomological Sciences PhD student Chris Bauer presented a summary of his PhD research on the elusive giant Palouse earthworm to a meeting of the Palouse Prairie Foundation June 9th in the Fisk Room of the 1912 building in Moscow. Bauer's research involved finding a way to definitively identify the worms, which have the scientific name Drillularis americanus. He wants to be able to identify the worm's species by swabbing DNA rather than killing them, which is how they are identified now. Bauer also has worked on mapping the DNA of the species, which have been found mainly in two geographic areas, the east side of the Washington Cascades and the Washington-Idaho Palouse region. Giant Palouse earthworm sightings were so rare that sometimes during the last century, there were decades between confirmed sightings. They became legendary for their size, but the specimens found in or near native Palouse Prairie habitat remnants in Whitman County and on Paradise Ridge look very similar to the European invasive earthworms that are found almost everywhere in North America called nightcrawlers. Today we bring you the first part of Chris Bauer's talk, June 9th.
So this is going to be an update on research and findings on the giant Palouse earthworm, Drillularis americanus. All earthworms belong to this class or subclass called Oligetes, depending on what systematicist or taxonomist you're talking to. Systematics in earthworm science is a giant mess. There's always people arguing about it. Oligo means few, and kite means bristles, or sometimes it's spelled with an S-C-T-E. Earthworms have these little tiny bristles, they're difficult to see in photographs. This is a photograph of, it's not the giant Palouse earthworm, but I wanted to show an estivating earthworm. You can identify earthworms from their sister taxa, the leeches and the polychaetes, by the segmentation. So it's a stack of donuts is their body plan. And each one of those segments has paired setae on them. There's some other species that have setae that go all the way around, sort of like a mohawk. And they're, of course, soft-bodied and invertebrates. They breathe through their skin, so when you find them on the surface, they're probably not having a good day. They're very sensitive to temperature and desiccation, drying out. Because they have to breathe through their skin, they have this mucus layer, and gas will diffuse across that mucus layer, but it has to be moist. When you go below the surface of into the soil surface, you get relative humidity at 95% really quickly. That's why they're in the soil. They're hermaphroditic, they've got both parts. Overall, earthworms can be as small as a few millimeters over, not in the case of giant Palouse earthworm, but there is one, the giant Gippsland earthworm. You can find videos of this, and it does get to a meter long. It's like that in diameter. It's really a big one. Probably approaching its physiological limits. That is Gippsland. That is in Australia.
Victoria, yeah.
And that's real. That's not a hoax. They're found nearly everywhere. The only continent you wouldn't find them is Antarctica. You'll find them wherever the temperature and the moisture allow. The big thing, this is how I got interested in earthworms in general, is that they're ecosystem engineers. And technically that means they modulate ecosystem processes. And that just means from their burrowing and their casts, their feces, they affect things like nutrient cycling. They mix organic layers with mineral layers. They affect the infiltration of water into the soil profile. That's why I was really interested in them. This one specifically, Drillularis americanus, that's its official name. Drillo means worm. Liris means lily-like, so it's a lily-like worm. It's the only known native earthworm species to the Palouse. The have to make sure I get that in the right order. It's not the only native species. It's the only native earthworm species to the Palouse Prairie, which makes it very interesting because I'm part of the Eiger program, and this team, along with a botanist, pollinator, ecologist, and an economist, we wanted to study the resilience of the Palouse Prairie. So this really is more of my disciplinary work on the Palouse Prairie. It's the only known native species. It was first described more than a century ago, 1897. Other than that, not a whole lot has been known about this species. I don't know its life history, how many there were, really anything other than its description as an organism. It's been listed as vulnerable according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature petition to list under the Endangered Species Act. That was rejected after a year. And it's been listed as a species of concern by Washington State. So this is a picture of the giant Palouse earthworm. We had this guy in the laboratory in a mesocosm. And he's pretty big. He's about 18 centimeters long, maybe about like that, maybe about a pinky in diameter. And this is where the ecosystem engineer, I like this slide because it shows the burrowing action. So this would have been the bottom of this little mesocosm. And if you look kind of closely, this globular structure, these are all earthworm casts. He was in there for about 4 years, just constantly churning that soil through his gut. So they take in soil organic matter. What comes out the other end is mostly soil organic matter. That's all for that slide. So this, I thought you might enjoy this, the original letter that accompanied the first specimens. So this was Doan, who used to work at, wasn't called WSU at the time, he was called the Washington Agricultural College, and he found 4 specimens of a previously undescribed earthworm species in a road cut. I haven't exactly figured out where this road cut is, but he sent this letter to Smith in Urbana, Illinois, my home state, and Smith identified them as a new species. It's on onion paper, that's why the scan came through. But I got this from the Smithsonian, who has all of Frank Smith's documentation. But I couldn't find the specimens. I pestered he works on aquatic earthworm species, so they're still oolichetes, but the micro drills.
Yeah.
And they can't tell me if it's in the building or not. And I know this guy Smith was a big time museum curator. And he was a museum guy. But the building was an old wooden structure, so it was all taken apart, and all of the contents were moved to the new science museum at Urbana, Champaign, Illinois. And no one can tell me where it is. I mean, if it were in a big room, I'd go spend a couple of weeks looking through it. But they couldn't tell me it was there, so I can't find that. So one of the things that came up, I'm just impressed that everybody came to listen to this. Most people don't care about earthworms at all. But one of the things that interests me is the Endangered Species Act, which I was not familiar with. So a lot of you are probably familiar that there was a petition to list the giant Palouse earthworm as an endangered species because it's rare and it's native to Palouse Prairie. Makes sense. But they have a very strict set of criteria. If you don't match these, you're not getting on the list, as I understand it. So this is the one that I found interesting. This is in the 12-month summary. And significant scientific uncertainties exist. And that's true. Well, we don't know the distribution, we don't know the extent, we don't know the life history. So what I wanted to do was try to answer some of those questions. I'm going to dip over here into is this species the same as that species? It's a big question. With earthworms, external morphology, or the shape, So they'll have different characters, the arrangement of setae, how many segments from the mouth to the clitellum, internal parts. Lumbricidae, which is a European family of earthworms. So these are all the earthworms that you're familiar with. They're in your gardens, they're the ones you grew up with. I grew up, this is a Lumbricus terrestris. I thought this was native to this country. No, we brought them all with us from Europe when we moved here.
Is that what we consider a nightcrawler?
Yes, that's what I call them. Oh, deer worms? I've never heard anyone call it that, but we call them nightcrawlers.
Yeah. There are the species of European earthworms.
Here.
Deer worms?
Yeah.
Oh, plenty, yes. And Lumbricid, these guys are easy. I can take every one of you, half hour, train you how to look at the external features, identify it. You spent a day, you would know how to identify earthworms. On the other hand, Megascelicidae, this is a giant blues earthworm we had in our collection. Very difficult. So to identify these two species, you have to open them up and identify all of these little tiny parts. And I am not a systematicist. I am not a taxonomist. Neither is my advisor, Jody Johnson Mayer. So what we wanted to do is we've got all these problems, right? So not very many taxonomists. There's two working taxonomists that I know, and they're both retirement age. Destructive conventional sampling, which means you go out with a shovel to find them, and to identify a giant blues earthworm, you have to euthanize them. And there's always this problem with juvenile earthworms. So if they don't have their adult characteristics, you just can't do anything. So this is why we wanted to use molecular methods, genetic methods, to address these problems. So all of that came together. My research goals was to develop a non-invasive diagnostic test. And non-invasive, I also mean non-destructive. We wanted to take advantage of what they're calling environmental DNA. So you might see this with wolves or ungulate, elk, that when they leave their scat behind, you can recover the DNA, analyze that, and identify them, track them, determine their parentage. You can't do that with the earthworms yet. But we wanted to do this with earthworm casts. Well, I'll get into the details there. Estimate a phylogeny, and all a phylogeny is how this specimen is related to this specimen. So there was the Smoothill discovery. So there's been a spotty collection of giant blues earthworm since it was originally discovered. And there was some discovered over around Chelan, so the Eastern Cascades. And the big debate, or the big question was, well, are these the same species? All right, well, that's a big question. 400 miles apart. They don't move that far. They're not commuting. So how are they related? So I wanted to estimate a phylogeny. And then Tim, actually, is going to be he's my collaborator. We're going to develop a predictive habitat model. So I actually, I'm a soil scientist, went out and collected soil data as well as sampled for eDNA, environmental DNA, and looking for the earthworms. We're going to develop a model that will give us sort of a heat map that will predict and say, well, it's likely that you would find a giant blues earthworm here, here, and here. Don't even bother looking over here. Then, of course, you got to go test the model. Nobody ever does that. They make these models. It looks great. And then they're done. They go get their PhD or their postdoc. Now, the DNA sampling, we wanted to try four different methods. Swabs, those would be similar to a buccal swab if you happen to be on the wrong end of a paternity suit. Live body swabs is what I'm calling them, and burrow swabs. So they burrow, or a purported burrow, because not every hole in the ground I put a swab into belonged to an earthworm. One came out just full of eggs. I'm pretty sure it was a trapdoor spider. One that just looked so promising, and there was a cicada in there. So. Yeah, so so burrow swabs as well.
What's the name of the burrow?
Yeah, scrapes of the burrow lining, so we scrape a little bit of the soil, and casts. So earthworm takes in soil. What comes out is mostly soil, a little aggregate. And then tissue is another one. So these are close-ups. This is a juvenile giant blue earthworm purported that we collected. So I will just clean this guy off and rub the swab, the sterile swab on there, and try to get some of those epithelial cells so we can get the DNA out of them. That has not been as successful. It's sort of a hit or miss. I'm not sure what I'm doing wrong, but somebody suggested a biopsy punch. And
ow.
I don't know. It's a couple millimeters. The person that suggested that, student, she's working with bats.
Oh.
And she felt good afterwards. She told me, she showed me the photographs, she recaptured the bats, and she could see where they were healing, so she didn't feel so bad. I don't know if the earthworms could take it. So swabs of the burrows, so this is a mesocosm that we had in the laboratory, swab for those. The scrapes, just scraping a little bit of that burrow lining, and then casts, which I thought would be the most successful. So once you see them, you'll see them everywhere now. So these little globular macroaggregates, that's the soil science term, those are earthworm casts. So when you go home, look at your garden, you'll see them everywhere. So those are earthworm casts. And hopefully, the DNA would be in there. But unfortunately, this is the best source of DNA. It is a tissue sample. This is a specimen that was turned in from Steptoe Butte by John Fleckenstein. Just happened to be in the wrong place when that shovel came looking for him. But he gave me the tissue, and I got a good sequence out of him, so gave his life for science. It's going to be a little genetics 101. Don't get anxious. You got any questions? Just wanted you to follow the workflow. Genetics is actually all new to me. I was trained as an analytical chemist, very interested in soil science, so this was all very new to me. But we want to collect those epithelial cells, so either the body external or the intestinal, you also have epithelial cells. Each one of those cells is going to have DNA in them, that's what we want. So we open those cells up, crack them open, lyse them, and we isolate the DNA. Amplify what's called CO1, COI, cytochrome oxidase 1.
You're listening to University of Idaho Plant, Soil, and Entomological Sciences PhD student Chris Bauer speaking at a Palouse Prairie Foundation meeting June 9th.
But you want to find out whose DNA that belongs to, you do this by sequencing. This is actually a fairly old technique at this point. It's very conventional. You might have heard of these next generation genetic sequencing techniques where they just generate your entire genome in an hour for $1,000. We don't have that instrument. We have this instrument. This is Sanger sequencing or dye termination. And we're going to just focus on one particular gene region or locus, and that's the CO1. But I'm working on these other three now. So that's a picture, up front picture of the instrument, the genetic analyzer. And this is one of the early results. Now this is a phylogeny. Yeah, better keep that. Just so a phylogeny, I know it looks complicated, but the way you want to read this, phylogeny is a relationship, how related, how similar or dissimilar is one specimen to another specimen. So all of these guys, these CWA23, CWA23-2, those are all individual specimens, individual sequences from those specimens, and the sequences are from CO1. So one locus, one sequence, one specimen. These are all individuals. Sometimes they call them taxa, but these nodes. And then you want to look at, I know this is very difficult to see, it says 0.05 substitutions per site. You remember that whole row of A, C, T, G? Every one of those sites could change. So you align all of those sequences and then see how many of them changed. And that tells you, in part, how similar one is to the other. So you look at the branch length, tells you follow that from one node. All right, I can see this is useful. Follow this and say, okay, that branch length, there you go. And what a hoot. So CO1. So five clusters. Some people use the term clade. It's an older term, and it's got some philosophical baggage still hanging on it. Clusters of similarity. This one up here. On yeah. So A. So you can see, right, this is a good example. So how many base pair substitutions do you think this is? Well, if this is 0.05, that's nothing. So they're very similar. They're nearly identical. So this is what we're doing is species delimiting. How close is this specimen related to this specimen? So these guys are all the same. This one's not very different. No, no. And when you do this analysis, and that's a whole, that's a couple presentations, how you do this analysis. It determines that this cluster, very similar. And then B, another cluster, and this is the interesting one. And cluster C, and then this is a, they call it outgroup. So this is in a different family. This is the most dominant exotic earthworm species found on Palouse Prairie, Aporectidea trapezoides. This one I found over by Uniontown. And if you follow this branch length all the way up here, everybody keep it count. You go all the way up to here, it's really big. Now, I have the tables that tell me how many actual numbers, but tables don't look good in presentations, just numbers. So you have to trust me, that's over half of that 650 base pair sequence of CO1 are different. So that's how different this exotic earthworm that's in a completely different family. So they give you a gauge of, well, how similar is this, how similar is that. And then these cluster D and E, you remember I told you about the other Drillaris genus, don't know what species it is, that were found in Oregon. And that's what these, I just put those two guys in to see how similar they are. They're in the same genus, but they're a different species. And this one, you may have spotted CWA, well, that's Cascades, and this is a resident, similar, I think you were telling me, somebody with a backhoe. So in their backyard, they were trenching, found an earthworm, sent it to us. But they're up in around Chelan, and the rest of these guys were in Oregon, Dallas County. So kind of interesting, I don't know where that's going to go, but I included them. And the code here, so PPR, it's Palouse Prairie, be Whitman and Latah County. Cascades, Eastern Cascades, CWA, and then OCR is the Oregon Coastal Range around Dallas County. And this is the big interesting one, this is the take home. So these guys, PPR, three of them, these two were found in Kamiak Butte, and this one was found in Steptoe Butte, and these guys are around Leavenworth. So we've got a group that are very similar to one another, nearly identical, less than 0.05, and very similar to specimens found in the Eastern Cascades. So that's a big take home. Yes, you find species in Palouse Prairie, and you find in the Cascades. The rest of this is gonna have to wait till I do the other three loci, because these are fairly long. And the official qualifier term is deep divergences, which means, well, we're not quite sure. It might be cryptic species, but it's going to be settled when I do these other, when I sequence these other three loci, do a partition analysis, and essentially you get a consensus. So four different loci, you get it. Here we are. Oh, you're right. I go. Oh, tell me about it. Okay, so that's interesting enough. I'm happy with that. still work to be done. But it becomes very interesting when you map those clusters spatially onto the map. So these are the stars there, are central Washington sites, and these are all the blue sites. I'm going to zoom in a little here. This is a little confusing. This is a composite. So we took all that space in between the Cascades and the Palouse and got rid of it. So this line, I mean, the scale is so big, but I want to show you these little fine points. So this is what we had to do. So this square right here is the Eastern Cascades. So you see Chelan there, Yakima, and this line, we got rid of all that intervening space, Whitman County, Latah, and you see, now you might be trying to tally these up. Some of them are right on top of each other. So there's Steptoe Butte and there's Kamiak Butte. That transect that John did was probably 100 meters long. So they're just over, you know, they're on top of each other, those two triangles. And then Oregon, that's where those that other Jovellaris species is, what was found. Okay, so here's close-up again. Remember, this is the dividing line. We just got rid of all that intervening space between this group on the Eastern Cascades and this group on the Palouse Prairie. And cluster A, they're distributed in these blue crosses. And cluster B, the interesting one, because here are the Palouse specimens, and here are Cascade specimens, and that analysis, that initial estimated phylogeny, says these are all in the same cluster. So pretty interesting. I mean, all kinds of questions. I mean, there's at least a postdoc out of this, if not more. So Jody has plenty of students, you know, research projects just on the shelf ready to go for the next student. Let me put them together. So there's cluster A and B, and now it becomes interesting. I'm like, well, they're right on top of each other here, this plus sign and red triangle, and there's spread through. It didn't include cluster C, and it wasn't because I couldn't figure out how to make a diamond, but there's one there, and one there. The A and the B I thought was enough for this presentation. So, some next steps. I've got to complete this diagnostic test, which is not making itself easy. Sequence those other three loci, make a consensus phylogeny. Hopefully it'll make a little more sense. Going to, there are some GenBank sequences. I know I told you there's one that says Drillolaris species, but there are about 200 reference sequences that are just called Megascolicidae. They were all collected by Sam James, who's the taxonomist who would know that. So I want to include those in my next phylogeny. So we could have a much broader scale throughout the Cascades, a plot along Seattle, and I think along the Columbia River. He sampled there. And then I told you Tim and I are collaborating on this predictive habitat model, where we're going to use soil data, climate data, and vegetation cover data to predict where we might expect to find the giant Palouse earthworm. The initial work was started by one of Jody's students, Shan Zhu, and she's going to be involved in this as well. But this is going to have to wait till the fall because I got to get this genetic stuff done. And I'm really hoping somebody will pick up the torch there and actually go look and say, well, map says you should find it here and go look for it there. So that's sort of the results portion. I thought I'd switch over. If anybody's got any questions now, we can wait. Or, yeah.
No samples from Latah County? Did they come in too late or too early? And
the sequences didn't. They're poor quality. So live swabs, they were mostly live swabs from Palouse Prairie samples. The new ones Cass Davis got those, just sequenced on Tuesday, and something went wrong because tissue samples, one of them didn't survive. That's not a euphemism. He really didn't survive. So I don't know what went wrong. I have to rerun that, but they will be coming from Lathaw County. Any other ones, or should I move on to?
Will you be sending that to us via email, since we signed up for your email?
Sending
the Lathaw County results.
That sign up was just for
Prairie
Foundation to notice the meetings and so forth.
Oh, okay. I'll get them.
It'll be published eventually. I don't know where. I'm sure you've got a Google alert for everything that says Giant Blue's Earthworm, right? So I think he'll spot it. Should I move on?
Okay.
So people have asked me, I went on a field trip with the Friends of the Clearwater and Sierra Club Branch, maybe Audubon was in there too, up on Paradise Ridge. People ask me questions. You know, if I happen to find this in the field, what am I looking for? So this is an adult specimen, giant blue's earthworm, that we had in the laboratory. And if you're out, I already told you that you can't identify the species just from the external features. You have to open them up and you have to know what you're looking for. But you can get an idea that it's a native earthworm, Drillolaris, and suspect, and then bring it to Joey's lab for confirmation. The first thing to look for is no pigmentation. So a lot of people look at this and it's kind of pinkish, fleshy color. Sometimes they're white. It's going to be kind of pinkish, blood color, or it might just be full of soil, so it'll just be very dark. That's what you want to look for. The Lumbricus terrestris, they have a reddish, brown, dark color. You can't see through it. Mm-hmm. That's what we mean by pigmentation with earthworms.
I've seen these in your lab, so I know.
Oh, yeah.
I think I saw one once. Okay, across the street at the Unitarian Universalist Church, I cut one in half accidentally, but I think I found two underneath the compost heap behind the church years ago when Dave Johnson was working with them.
Two of Drillaris, you think?
Yeah, they were clean, cream colored.
Okay.
And one I exposed, well, one was hiding underneath a layer of leaves I had set down.
Okay.
It's a long story, so I won't go into it, but I'll write it up and send it to you.
Well, it's going to help you, so it wouldn't just be the one thing, the pigmentation. That's one feature to look for.
The big one is
this one. This platellum is this structure right here. So it's kind of a saddle shape.
Yeah.
And you've seen them with, you know, night crawlers. It's just a raised ridge close to its mouth part. And what you want to do is count the segments, which is not easy when they're moving. But you can get close because the number of segments to the platellum for the giant blue's earthworm, it's about 13, about 12.
Compared to our regular earthworm, which is what?
For Lumbricus, which is 33. So it's a third. So that's what gives you a good idea that it may be the giant blue's earthworm. And the other bit is this bulbous tail. I think I've got, so you may have seen Lumbricus terrestris, if you annoy them and they want to retreat. They flatten their tail, sort of like a beaver tail almost looks like. These guys don't do that. So you find one. I've got some more pictures to show you more details. But people ask, am I killing the last unicorn in the forest? And earthworms, if you find them on the surface, and Cass has found lots of them, they're not having a good day. If they're not below ground, they've got to stay moist. That's why you might find them after a rain. That's where they're going to get predated upon. The sun is going to bake them. They're probably not going to make it. And a couple of casts turned in, they don't look too good. They're out on the surface. They've been out too long. Why they're out there, what they're looking for, I'm not sure.
Can they drown?
They can. But the variation within all the earthworms is incredible. I mean, just the tolerance for low oxygen or high CO2 is enormous. I should have brought that picture. There's a really neat one in Africa that is adapted. It's an earthworm species that's adapted to almost always flooded soil, and it's adapted its tail where it sort of curves to increase surface area and sort of uses it as a, almost like a lung. So it sticks itself up out of the water, the saturated soil, in order to breathe. But this one was fairly tolerant. We tried Americanus, a burrowing experiment trying to determine the shape of their burrows. So we had to flood the burrow, or flood the mesocosm, to get them to come out. And it took hours. They just didn't mind. And every time we'd come in to get him, he'd see us and then shrink back in. So it took a while to get him out of there. But another factor, if you're out and you're just like, oh, I found a giant blue earthworm, they're probably exotic. Just the vast majority of earthworms teeth coming from Asia as well. But if you do think, you know, you see those features, no pigmentation, the clitellum's really close to the front end, and that's the last one. But my advisor tells me if you hold a giant blue earthworm and run your fingers along, because there should be, if you look at a clock, there should, I'm like hidden in the eye, am I saying?
No.
Okay. You'd find, so if this is a cross section of the earthworm, they have all different combinations, but you'll have closely paired, there'll be two pair, two pair, two pair, two pair. So maybe 11 o'clock, 1, 5, and 7. And those would be endogig. And the ones that hang out on the surface, like Lumbricus terrestris, they'll have two here at 8 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7, and 5. Because they're traveling on the surface more. That's what the little hooks are for, the little bristles. But Jody tells me if you hold a giant blue earthworm and you run your fingers along the body surface, you don't really feel those setae because they're so small. But with Lumbricus terrestris, it's almost like sandpaper. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can really feel
them. Well, Ding told me that you'd feel them at about 8 and 4 o'clock as you ran your hand down it, and that's what I felt. And it just, he said it would also pull out of the burrow without breaking.
I don't recommend that, but...
Well, this was the one I had accidentally cut in half. Let me write up the whole thing, and I'll send it as an email, because it would take too long for me to explain.
I've got some cards up here for my email address. So if you do think you're looking at a giant blue earthworm, how do you collect them? And this is what I do. I carry a plastic baggie, a Ziploc baggie with me. Or if you're just out, just use any plastic bag. Find some moist soil, not sopping, not saturated, just a little bit moist, or a paper towel or a cloth. Just the idea is you want to have a moist environment inside the bag. And I put a little air, so just puff a little air in there for a cushion, so you can put it in your knapsack. They are soft-bodied, you know, and they'll get crushed. And you want to keep them dark and cool, 60 degrees, or if you're European persuasion, 15C. You could get away with putting them in the crisper. So Cass dropped off some to me. I just turned my refrigerator down and kept them in the crisper until I got in the lab. They worked fine. And then note the location. GPS, of course, is best, but if you can point onto on a map, that's fine with me. So these are some pictures. Joe Sazi found this one up on Paradise Ridge while he was mountain biking. So this is a picture, and I think he's probably 18, maybe about that long, maybe that. So he decided he was going to bring it in. This is one that Cass collected, I think it was like 2 years ago. It wasn't on Iverson, but that's just what I called it. So here's where ridge, but you can see where the clitellum's going to form. So this is kind of what you can do is say, well, yeah, that's not 32 segments. That's probably 10 or 11. But this is what I mean when I say they look kind of lumpy. Is when they're starting to die, they just get lumpy like that, and they just don't make it. And then this is that bulbous tail I was telling you about.
That was part of a talk by University of Idaho Plant, Soil, and Entomological Sciences PhD student Chris Bauer, speaking at a Palouse Prairie Foundation meeting June 9th at the 1912 Center in Moscow. Bauer was talking about his research into the very rare North American native Palouse earthworm, Drillolaris americanus, also known as the giant Palouse earthworm. This spring, Paradise Ridge resident Cass Davis found six live specimens of what are likely giant Palouse earthworms on a small section of Paradise Ridge, which he brought to Bauer at the University of Idaho for research. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events, and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. Remember, all editions of the KRFP Evening Report are available for download and streaming on the KRFP website shortly after broadcast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great 4th of July holiday.